Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Welcome back to the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. It's the Ailish Hour, hour four of the Fan Morning Show podcast. As always, subscribe, download, five stars. Today was Text Line Tuesday. We'll continue that throughout this hour. Whatever you want to talk about, including your thoughts on Yusei Kikuchi, we can handle that. I can handle that. Maybe it's a little therapy session on 590. We were talking about a lot of things throughout the first 3 hours, and we'll continue that. We're going to do a little bit of World Juniors with Stephen Ellis from the Hockey News later, and then we have Nate Geary up to talk some Buffalo Bills first. But I want to start with our feel-good story of the day, because I think everybody in Toronto needs a little feel-good energy right now. The Houston Astros, usually not a feel-good story in this town, but they did put on a special night for the victims of Uvalde and the school shooting. So they honored the town that was devastated, obviously, in late May, by giving away thousands of tickets to the residents and bussed them all in, sold shirts, and all the proceeds went towards their recovery, held a 50-50 raffle where the winner got $10,000. So some really awesome stuff. But the game as well had some incredible narratives. So before the game started, a young fan requested that Alex Bregman hit a home run for her. This is what happened.
2-0 count here as he hits one high. He hits one deep. Alex Bregman for the second straight game makes it 2-0.
So Alex Bregman goes yard in the bottom of the first inning with his first at-bat of the game. He comes back to the dugout and everyone says, you know, you did that for the kids. You did that for the community. It was pretty cool to see. Obviously, an emotional day for everybody there, but especially for that young fan who got her wish. And Alex Bregman got to speak to the media afterwards about this really special moment. And this is what he had to say.
It was really cool. Just anything we can do for them. I'm glad they were here today. I think it's really nice what the Astros have done to try and help in the healing process. And as soon as I got into the dugout, Dusty goes, "Hey, you hit one for Evaldi." So it was nice.
How cool is it to win for them as well?
Oh, it was great to get a win. Just to have them here and be able to watch an Astros win. Hopefully they had fun at the game and enjoyed it, and hopefully they can continue to have fun watching Astros baseball for years to come.
A really special story that happened just a couple days ago. I wanted to make sure that everyone got a little bit of a heartwarming start to their Tuesday. They did go on to win the game, too, as he mentioned. So keep with the good vibes here. Nate Geary, our Buffalo Bills pregame and halftime show host on WGR 550. Good morning, Nate.
Well, good morning to you as well. How are you?
I am good. The Bills undefeated. Open up.
That's all that matters.
Yeah, you know, that's all we need. Is it time to plan the parade down there in Buffalo?
Yeah, you know, preseason in Buffalo here, we are, it's very important to us, actually. It's funny, I kind of spent the last like week and a half talking about how I kind of don't care at all about this preseason. It's just been like one of those things where the real goal of this preseason is just like get out unscathed. Don't have a Zach Wilson type injury to anybody on the team. No surgeries, no missed time, no hamstrings, no nothing. So yeah, here in Buffalo right now, I think the main thing is how do we get to week one with no injuries and no issues outside of that.
Do you take a lot of stock in watching, at least for your content on your show, any of the new faces or any of the new systems, or is it just like hard to really evaluate because of lack of the actual players really being put in these positions?
Yeah, you know, I think the system conversation is interesting. Obviously, Ken Dorsey being the new offensive coordinator. There are certain things you're kind of watching for during these games, but the game plans are so vanilla. They're so watered down. NFL teams are, like, historically scared to – it's like they've got government secrets or something that they're worried about giving up, which I always find kind of funny, like, you know, like especially, like, fans videotaping practices as if, like, you know, other teams, GMs and coaches are just – you know, champing at the bit to see people on Twitter posting quick one play synopsis of practice, and that's going to completely ruin their game plan come week one. But, you know, I think there are a couple of things that, like, you know, week one I was kind of taking away, and it's really the play of their two young corners, Christian Benford, their sixth round pick, and obviously Kyer Elam, their first round pick. You know, they've been sort of touted through the start of training camp as being two rookies sort of playing above their weight class, so to speak. And I think against the first team offense of the Indianapolis Colts last week, I think if you're going to take anything away, it's that those two rookie corners against starting caliber quarterback wide receiver combinations of a team that's likely to win their division in Indianapolis, they held their own. So I think if I'm going to take anything away from week one, it's just that those rookie corners really are kind of ready to take the step and be asked to take on, I think, a lion's share of their duties, considering we still don't really know what's going to happen, you know, with Tre'Davious White, if he's going to be available for week one.
Okay, so some of those new faces, I feel like you mentioned Elam. I think that he was the most impressive to me just because it seems like he's maybe on the cusp of I don't know, correct me if I'm getting too excited, but maybe being able to make an immediate impact come week one.
I think that's the hope. I think right now, you know, seeing Dane Jackson not playing that game probably is a hint to all of us that right now he's sort of got the edge for that number two cornerback position on the other side of Tre'Davious White if he's healthy. Now, if Trey White starts the season on the PUP list or he gets activated, but maybe he's not exactly 100% ready to go week one, I could see Kyer Elam starting on the other side of Dane Jackson. But ultimately, I do think that Elam will at some point here sort of take that number two cornerback position. Now, the thing you have to kind of understand with Kyer Elam coming out of Florida, he was in the top of this corner draft class. He was kind of considered the more raw of the three top corners in this draft. He was kind of the guy that could get by with press man coverage. And what you know about corners coming from college to the NFL, playing NFL zones, understanding the concepts, understanding your responsibilities, there is a transition there. So I think with him, there was always going to be a sort of transitional period for him to sort of adapt to the NFL game. I think we've seen early on having a chance to go and practice against Stephon Diggs every day, against Gabriel Davis every day, that set him up for success. So I think from an immediate impact perspective, I do think he's going to have opportunities early, but I do think right now this is Dane Jackson's job, and it's not an indictment on the first round pick. I think more so this is an organization in a very unique position, right? They are a Super Bowl contender. If you look across the league, they're kind of the Super Bowl favorite. So I think you don't want to rock the boat too much. I think you want to refer and defer to guys that have done it before, guys, veterans. And I think the same conversation could be had about, like, running back, for instance, right? And we saw this Blackshear kid have two touchdowns in the fourth quarter, and he's an undrafted free agent. You know, and now the talk is, like, could he overtake Zach Moss as the third running back? And I kind of like, well, hold your role here. I don't think a team in a Super Bowl window, in a win now window, is going to make a move like, hey, let's use this undrafted free agent over a guy we drafted in the third round 2 years ago. And I kind of think the same thing about Kyer Elam right now. Although they spent that first round pick on him, in a Super Bowl window, you kind of want to make sure you got your T's crossed, your I's dotted. And with that, I think you kind of defer to the veteran until that rookie is really able to sort of establish himself.
So we saw, as you mentioned, a couple of the rookies really leading the way. I think all of their touchdowns are actually scored by rookies in that first game. Khalil Shakir, I was impressed, obviously, heavily targeted. Came away with a reception on every opportunity. I think he led the team with catches and yards. But he seemed to be put in a little bit of a versatile role. Where do you see him fitting maybe down the road here?
It's a great question. I think he showed a lot in that first game. So same with Isaiah Hodgins, too, by the way. He's been a rookie, but he's had two seasons where he's been riddled by injuries. And I thought both of those guys really stood out to me. There is a spot on this roster for Khalil Shakir. I know he's a fifth-round pick, and maybe people would look at that and say, well, he's a fifth-round pick. He's not a third-round pick. He's not a second-round pick. But this is a guy, I think, universally, when the Bills selected him in the fifth round, there was a lot of sort of eyebrows from draft people, that especially people that I spoke to, that said sort of along the lines of, like, not really sure how this guy made it to the fifth round. He's versatile. He can play both inside and outside. I think during that first preseason game, we saw a real glimpse of him getting extended action at the outside receiver, something that he did in part in college at Boise State. But for the most part, I think he was looked at universally as like a slot guy, which could have hurt his draft stock a little bit, right? When you don't have that versatility, when you're a slot-only guy, that it could potentially hurt your draft stock. And I think that did that. But now he's showing that, you know, and listen, when you talk to anybody that covered Boise State football, all they could talk about was Khalil Shakir, the guy off the field, a hard worker, a leader, a guy that you want and that guys gravitate towards. So I think that made a lot of sense from the Bills' perspective. That's the kind of guys this organization tend to flock to, tend to gravitate towards, guys that have that sort of vibe about them. But I think what surprised me early on is his ability to play both inside and outside, be versatile. I think there's a very good chance he's this team's punt returner when the season starts. So, yeah, I think he's a lock on this roster right now. And I've been pleasantly surprised by how good he has looked this early, considering it is a bit of a transition from a WAC school, a school like Boise State that's not really playing the big SEC schools, the Big Ten schools. So to see him make this transition and look so good so early, again, against those Indianapolis starters, I think is a really is a great sign for him.
I love that you mentioned the off-the-field locker room ask. I'm big on the vibes. That was pretty much my role as an athlete. So I love to hear that. And I think it's really important. And I know the Bills obviously have that ritual and that that type of outward vibes that we know as fans. You saw the Case Keenum, the hidden little camera things he done. It's really fun to watch Bills from social media, at least. So another guy that has been praised for having that type of locker room presence is Von Miller, and he obviously the splashy free agency acquisition. How's he been acclimating right now in camp?
Yeah, I think you're kind of referring to like their overall ethos, right? Like sort of the feel of the locker room. Mm-hmm. And I think you're spot on with transitioning to Von Miller in this conversation, because, you know, obviously a lot's made. I kind of refer to him as like the coolest dude in football. Like he really is. And it's sometimes still surreal for me to think about the fact that he is a Buffalo Bill. He has such a national brand, a national recognition that, you know, at least in my experience, my time as both a fan and somebody that, that works and covers for the team, you know, I think those kind of guys being here, the last guy I can kind of think of is like T.O., but it was kind of a very different cool. It was a very rebellious cool. It was anti-establishment cool. And this is a very different time for the Bills to have Von Miller. It's not just that he's taken Greg Rousseau, the other, you know, highly touted first round pick from last year and sort of putting his arm around his shoulder and guiding him through some of his, and helping him understand technique and all this stuff like that. That's great. And that has been very visible. But to me, it's not just when he's taking aside the Greg Rousseaus or the Boogie Bashams, guys that are highly involved and will be relied upon this year, guys that are a big part of the organization. You see him working on the side with guys that are fringe roster players, mm-hmm. guys that aren't going to make the 53-man roster. And the same attention, the same knowledge that he's passing to the guys that he knows are going to be here, that are going to help him get to the goals he's looking to get to. He's also willing to take the time for those guys that, let's be honest, are fanboying a little bit, right? Like they're around Von Miller. They're, you know, small school guys that, you know, are fringe NFL players that are fighting for their lives. And something they pick up from Von Miller technically could be the reason that maybe they cling on in another team or a practice squad here or somewhere else. So that's the thing that stood out to me. It's not just the other guys that are at the top of the roster. It's also some of the stuff he's willing to do with the guys that maybe we aren't talking about mm-hmm. so much.
I mean, I think that's just so valuable, especially with this team that has high expectations this season. like the highest of expectations, really having a mature, experienced leader. I think that's really invaluable, and I'm sure down the road we'll praise what he's been able to bring. In terms of what he can bring on the field, what are you expecting? You know, he's 33 years old, and people mm-hmm. sometimes ask questions about where he is in his career. Do you think he can be as impactful on the team as he is off the team?
I do, yeah. And I think, you know, there's been this sort of glossing over of this move. And maybe it's because I'm looking at it as the Bills got a walk off the bus first ballot Hall of Famer mm-hmm. in Von Miller, which he is. I mean, let's be honest. But this is a guy that is coming off an incredibly productive playoff run with the Los Angeles Rams. I'm not convinced that at 33 years old, this is a guy that is going to be back into single digits, is going to be playing 35-40% of the snaps. I think this is a guy that is intending on coming in here, playing 60-65% of the snaps, playing on first down as a run defender, but also, you know, being their best edge rusher on third down. I think, you know, the people that are, you know, I think I saw him ranked 93rd in the NFL 100 list. I think that's criminally low for a player coming off a really productive playoff push and a Super Bowl win, by the way. But more so, you know, I think about some of the other moves for veteran defensive ends that were made this offseason that are getting far more praise, far more attention. You know, Khalil Mack, who, by the way, really hasn't played meaningful football since when? He hasn't really been a playoff performer because he hasn't played on teams that have made the playoffs very often. And last year, he missed a ton of time to injury. Yet that move is sort of universally like, wow, Mack and Bosa, that's going to be a really unstoppable tandem in Los Angeles. And then, you know, you talk about Jones, Chandler Jones, the defensive end that Las Vegas goes out and signs. They trade Yannick Ngakoue to the Indianapolis Colts. And now you've got Max Crosby, who's kind of this up-and-coming elite defensive end. He's going to be matched up with Chandler Jones. And that's sort of talked about as like this great move that was made. And maybe part of it is the money that was reported 6 years, $120 million for Von Miller. That's not really the deal. It's much shorter and much less money guaranteed than that. But it's kind of the way that an agent goes out and shows how much money that the contract could potentially be. Make no qualms about it. It's not going to be a six-year, $120 million deal. Mm-hmm. And maybe part of that's the reason people aren't looking at it with the same, with the same energy there with some of these other guys. But I think in terms of teams that went out and signed a veteran or traded for a veteran, it's hard to find, in my opinion, a guy who's playing as good this late in his career than Von Miller, and that's moving into a Super Bowl roster. It could be the thing that kind of pushes them over the top.
Do you think he's going to be successful in recruiting Odell Beckham Jr.?
I do. I do believe that. Listen, I kind of said this the other day on your station when I was on with the afternoon guys, and maybe I'll stop short of saying like it's some sort of done deal. Mm-hmm. But I want to tell you that I think there's a very good chance that when Odell Beckham Jr. is healthy and ready to sign, that the Bills are A, on top of the list here, and B, I think it'll be very telling what this team does coming out of having to get their roster down to 53. If they leave with six receivers, now they ended training camp last year with seven rostered receivers on the 53-man roster. Now, six of them dressed. So not all seven of them were playing week in and week out. But if they walk out with six at the position, I think that's a telltale sign that this is a team that intends at some point here to sign Odell Beckham Jr. So I think they've got a little bit of maneuvering to do to get there. This isn't going to be a long-term, you know, $30, $40, $50 million contract for Odell Beckham Jr. I think it'll be a one-year, you know, couple million, highly incentivized deal. But I think with Von Miller, one of his best friends off the field, with Josh Allen, this offense, I think he's the kind of guy that in November, December could come in and really provide the type of high-end pass catching that this team potentially could need to get over a team like Kansas City, like Las Vegas, like Los Angeles. And I'll tell you, it would be an exciting world to have mm-hmm. Odell Beckham Jr., Von Miller, Stephon Diggs, some of the names this team would have. It would be hard for me to find a time in my lifetime where you'd have a more exciting top of the roster than that.
Yeah, the vibes alone, once again, would just continue to skyrocket. So you mentioned receivers, and obviously we know who the number one is. Seems like Gabriel Davis might be number two in that. Where mm-hmm. do you see Isaiah McKenzie slotting into this kind of like a little bit of a knot in terms of receivers?
Yeah, I think that he is easily the most talked about guy throughout training camp, and for good reason. It's not symbolic. It's not charitable. It is real deal. He had maybe the best camp of anybody on the team. He did more to help his case than I can really think of any other player on this roster. I think right now he is slotted as this team's number three wide receiver. I do not think that I'm a little disappointed, frankly, in what we saw early in this training camp, just from Jamison Crowder, a guy that I think a lot of people had just thought de facto he was going to walk in and take over Cole Beasley's position full time, be the slot receiver, be the guy on third down that Josh Allen can trust, can get to, always finds a way to get open. And we have not really seen that. He missed the first like 10 practices, which really hurt him. And in those 10 practices that were missed, Isaiah McKenzie simply took advantage of his time with the starting offense. I think he's got a grip of that job. And I think short of an injury, short of some sort of off the field incident, he is going to be the guy in that number three role as a full-time player. And I'm starting to wonder, and a lot of people will tell you, you know, Jamison Crowder's $1.3 million guaranteed contract this year prohibits them from potentially just cutting him outright. But I'm going to tell you, I don't think $1.3 million, if it means potentially having a roster spot later on down the line for Odell Beckham, potentially allowing Khalil Shakir more of an offensive role as the team's number four receiver. Maybe it's Isaiah Hodgins. I think you're going to have a tough time right now if you're Jamison Crowder making the team because of the strides that Isaiah McKenzie made during training camp.
I'll say sometimes a little competition for roster spots is never a bad thing, but it certainly feels like he's kind of solidified himself in that role. I know we mentioned the new offensive coordinator this year. How much different do you think that's going to be in Josh Allen's world, especially compared to what we've seen with the Daboll system?
I don't think it's going to be world different. I do think there's obviously going to be a change. And I think that change is going to be more of a philosophical one and less of a maybe practical one. And what I mean by that is I think part of what – and here's the great part about Ken Dorsey, right? Like, this is a guy that I think every NFL player knows in some capacity from his time at the U, right? Like, he is the face of – maybe some of the coolest U teams, the Miami University teams of the early 2000s you can get, right? And so because of that, he has a level of respect in the locker room. Josh Allen has worked with Ken Dorsey since his rookie season. I don't think there's some sort of giant philosophical change that's going to happen short of, Josh, what we want you to do is win from the pocket. And when you are running, get out of bounds, slide. Don't take those hits. We don't need – I think there's going to be less designed Josh Allen runs. And in place of those runs, I think they're going to rely on the running back in the passing game a little bit more as a dump down, as a check down option for Josh Allen so that he's not relied upon to be the guy that has to put his head down and fight for an extra yard. Having said that, I do believe what you want to have Josh Allen do, what you want to do, is keep him available, keep him healthy, so that in December, in January, and hopefully February, you can rely on him to be that physical runner, and you don't have those miles on him from a game in September or October where you don't want him trying to run over a linebacker when you know he can still do that. And this is the window for him to still be this type of quarterback that runs the football and is dangerous with his legs. This won't last forever, this window for Josh Allen. So save it for December. Save it for January and February. And I think that'll be the biggest philosophical difference. But I think this team is going to rely on the running back in the passing game a little bit more. I think you're going to see more two tight end, three tight end sets. But I think a lot of the same principles Brian Daboll established with this offense being as good as they were as a pass-heavy offense, I think those are going to remain. They could even pass the ball more when they kind of include the running back in here as well.
Is it looking like an MVP season for Josh Allen this year?
I mean, he is kind of the running favorite right now. I would tell you that it's probably not in the front of Josh Allen's mind.
That's probably best.
he truly is. And I know it's so cliche and you hear it all the time, but he really is sort of like that team first guy. I think MVP is really the product of having the best team. And when you have the best team, you tend to have the best quarterback that year. So if this is a 14-win football team, like a lot of people are predicting, I think it's very possible that he walks away with the MVP. I think for me, the biggest difference this year will be is can he become a little bit, this is what I talked about last year, is this offense under Brian Daboll really maneuvered and was at home in some of the most difficult concepts and areas of the field. They are a downfield passing team, right? And for him to have a 60-plus percentage completion percentage, to be the MVP runner-up or in second or third in voting, when they really had no built-in layups in this offense, easy plays to get him going. I think that's the first thing. And yards after catch, right? I mean, they were 31st last year in yards after catch. If Josh Allen in this offense can find some success after the catch, if Josh Allen feels more comfortable dumping the ball down and getting some easier plays in the repertoire, that's really where I think he could take the step into MVP this year, where he's not asked to do all the really difficult things all the time, that they can build in some layups, build in some slam dunks in this offense that give him some bonus yards. You know, Tom Brady throws for 4,500 yards or whatever, and, you know, 75% of it comes after the catch. Josh Allen's doing all of that through the air. So I think if you can start to build in and phase in some of the yards after catch, I think that'll be a real big determinant, you know, whether or not he wins an MVP.
Okay, Nate, last one before I let you go. We got the Bills GM tomorrow on the show. Anything you'd want to ask him right now?
Ooh, Brandon Bean. Mm-hmm. Well, so I'm going to tell you, he does not like to talk about ongoing contracts. So don't ask him about Jordan Poyer, because okay. you'll just get it won't even be worth your
It'll
time.
It'll be PR.
But, yeah, right, exactly. But, you know, one thing that I've always found really interesting with Brandon Bean is his relationship with players. And this dates back to his time in Carolina. And, you know, I remember when he sort of took over for Doug Whaley, that when you looked at some of the – it's weird, I'm going to say highlights of general managers, but whenever there's video being panned over to Brandon Bean on the sideline as the assistant GM in Carolina, he's always around the players. He's flapping up players, talking about players. And I think he is kind of one of the very rare player GMs. How important are those relationships with the players? Because I think for him, you look around the league, the GM is sort of known as the boss. And I don't really think, same with the head coach, I don't really think the team looks at him as like this boss, this guy that they are sort of walking on eggshells around. He really has built this kind of culture within the organization that he is kind of one of them, not above them. And I think that's a really unique thing to the league. So how much like those player relationships sort of mean to him and earning respect in what he does?
I love it. I will definitely reiterate that question for him tomorrow. Appreciate you coming on today, Nate. I'm excited about Bill's season up ahead. We will probably catch up with you as soon as the season begins.
Looking forward to it. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Nate. Nate Geary, Buffalo Bills pregame and halftime show host on WGR 550. Bills and the NFL back in action this weekend. They are playing Saturday at 1 p.m. Just a beautiful, beautiful time slot. A couple games this weekend continuing on. They're playing the Broncos. So lots to come. I love the Von Miller angle. I also love the Brandon Bean conversation about player relationships. Just seems like vibes and team is really an important thing around the Bills this season, which I do believe makes championship teams. So number one Super Bowl favorite odds. Maybe that plays into it. We're going to take a break and head into some World Juniors conversation. Canada caps off the prelims with a 6-3 win over Finland yesterday, finishing atop Group A with a perfect 4-0 record. Is this one of the best Team Canadas we've seen in recent history? That's next with Stephen Ellis from the Hockey News on the Ailish Hour on the Fan Morning Show. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
We're back on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. It's the Ailish Hour, hour four of the Fan Morning Show on podcast. Lots of good things happening in the Canadian teams in terms of success. Also, the Canadian women's team announcing their roster. I'll get to that after our interview with Stephen Ellis, because of course, you know, I got thoughts on that. Very excited for their upcoming world championships, but currently going on. World Juniors, whether you know it or not, a quiet tournament, but Stephen Ellis from the Hockey News is there in Edmonton. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing well. It's great to chat with you. You're down on the, you know, right on the grounds. Lots of attendance issues or conversations online. We've been seeing those empty arena photos. What's the vibe been like around the city?
It's kind of walking around the city. There's not much kind of to indicate the tournament's even happening. There's a big Boston Pizza with a bunch of flags and stuff, but that's kind of really it outside of the rink. And it's disappointing because, you know, just talking to fans, people are saying like the ticket prices are outrageous. I know that's kind of one of the things that maybe isn't being talked about enough, where the quarterfinal games tomorrow, the Finland-Germany game at 10 in the morning here, those tickets are like $80 for the cheapest seats. And that's not going to sell out, especially when it's a work day. So it's kind of been, it's been disappointing to see that.
Classic Boston Pizza though. Like, is that not the most hockey? I remember after tournaments, you just go to BP. That was the spot. So I'm not surprised that they're like the only ones advertising it. So it seems like, yeah, there's obviously a bit of a cloud over this tournament, to say the least. Not really something that the current players have probably ever had to experience. Is that a topic of conversation around the rink? Is there been any conversations on what's going on with Hockey Canada, or are you expecting that to be a post-tournament type of thing?
Yeah, obviously all the stuff surrounding Hockey Canada, that obviously it hasn't been ignored. That's been a big topic, but I guess that's just part of one of just the many factors why it is empty. The fact that a lot of these games, because the fact that every game is being played in the same arena means there are games that are much earlier in the day. So like when you've got an unfavorable matchup for kind of local people here at a noon game, and it's two teams people don't really care about, and the tickets are $50-$60, that's obviously not going to sell out. And then a lot of the top stars are not there. The fact is this is a summer tournament, which has never been kind of big for tickets. The Wayne Gretzky was just on the week before that, and not far from here in Red Deer. We saw there they had attendance issues too. So, again, just a lot of factors, but of course, kind of just everything going on with Hockey Canada. We haven't heard anything major new during this tournament, which I guess if you're Hockey Canada, you're probably saying, okay, that's a great thing for now, but obviously that's something that can't be ignored.
So whether people are watching or not, or attending or not, are we seeing one of the best teams for Team Canada in recent history?
It's tough to say because they've definitely been the most dominant team here, and right now it's looking like Canada and USA are probably the two teams headed for the final. But without Cole Perfetti, without Shane Wright, without Caden Gooley, Owen Power, like this team's definitely missing some talent. But they've really had no problem kind of getting to this point. They looked much better than Finland. They looked a lot better than Czechia. And those are two pretty solid teams. So they're going to play Switzerland in the corner final, a game I expect they are going to win. But then it's tough there. You got to worry about potentially Sweden. And then if the Americans make the final, because they can't play each other until the final, then we really will see how they kind of stack up.
So leading the way, obviously, the headliners, Connor Bedard, even Mason McTavish now. But let's start with Connor Bedard. 3 goals, 4 assists so far. The hype was there. Is his performance living up to that so far?
Absolutely. You know, he's one of the top scorers in this tournament. He's been so good so far. You know, yeah, he's sure he maybe hasn't exploded and gotten like 16, 17 points already, like some people were predicting. But this is a guy that he's worth the admission just to watch him, and he's been so much fun to watch. You know, he's got an incredible shot. I feel like if he was in the NHL next season, he would already have a top five shot. He's got the speed, he can play with anybody, but that chemistry he's got with McTavish has been so much fun. So this is special. We'll be able to see him again in the winter tournament, but if you get a chance to watch Bedard in person, you got to make it happen.
I know it sounds outrageous to say that his shot could be a top five in the league, but just watching the release alone, like it's stunning. Is that something that you saw a growth in just from last year to this year? Because last tournament, he was a 13th forward, and now he's obviously one of the top players in the tournament.
Yeah, for sure. Like, this is a guy that I think the biggest thing I've really noticed in his game is he's a lot more aggressive than he used to be. He's really getting in players' heads. And I know it's something like Ridley Gregg's been doing really well, where it seems like every time he's on the ice, players are noticing. But, like, obviously when Bedard's on there, players are trying to zero in on him. But he's taking advantage of that. He's been physical. But then, yeah, his shot just continues to get better. I remember watching him 3-4 years ago and thinking, like, this guy's, like, his shot is already just stupid good at that age. And it continues to get better. And when you look at his speed, his playmaking continues to improve. So just overall, kind of like everything what we saw in the winter looked really good, but he's just taken everything to another step.
If you were to critique Connor Bedard, which is a difficult thing, where does his growth need to happen before he's that eventual probably number one draft choice?
It's tough to say because when the guy's
he's
been kind of when he's kind of compared to McDavid for so long, it's tough. But I'd say maybe I'd like to see him be a bit more aggressive defensively, kind of around the net. And you know, he can play center, he can play wing, and he's kind of played both in this tournament. And but I'd say it maybe just kind of be a bit more aggressive in his own zone, attacking the players, and kind of going from there.
Pretty good that if it's just one thing that you can kind of improve on and you're compared to Connor McDavid, he's on a good path. Hopefully he can sustain that. He's got some big things this upcoming season in terms of all his hockey ahead. So Mason McTavish, another huge star, obviously, for Canada, is leading the tournament with scoring. Is he too good for this tournament?
If you told me he was like 23 in disguise, I would believe you. This is a guy that he's always kind of been like mature above his age. He plays such an NHL style game. He's very physical. He could be very strong, very good shot, very smart. Again, plays with anyone. And it takes a lot to be able to play so effectively with a guy like Bedard, because sure, he's one of the best players right now in this age group, and no one could deny that. But then you bring in a guy like McTavish, who's played the Olympics, who's played the Memorial Cup, he's played the NHL, AHL already. He's had to adapt to playing for everybody, and he's been good everywhere. So to me, I think the Anaheim Ducks have I don't know if I'm going to say a star at this point, but this is a guy who's going to be a really big player for them for a long time, and I'm excited to kind of see what he does. He's ready for the NHL.
That's exactly where I was going in terms of the Ducks. Like, they got a young, feisty team, and clearly he's going to be like seamlessly in the lineup next year. Is that something you think is going to be even more of an opportunity for him to play on a team with a bunch of young guys and kind of have a little bit less pressure on his shoulders?
Absolutely. The Ducks does not a lot of high expectations, and I think that's a good thing, where he'll go out there and he'll probably play a key role kind of right away. And that's something that I think they were kind of hoping like Troy Carey would be able to do right away. And it took him a few years and he figured it out. And I think that's just kind of the next step here for McTavish. He'll have a chance to play with a guy like Zegras, and we know how talented he is. And so the Anaheim Ducks are building something pretty good here. Owen Zellweger, the defenseman, has been one of the offensive drivers here for Canada too. And he's probably not too far away. So the Ducks have a bright future, and McTavish is going to be a big part of that.
So we got the big names, obviously, kind of crossed them off the list. Who's impressed you the most from Team Canada that we're maybe not giving enough airtime to here?
I'd say, well, Dylan Garand, the goaltender, you know, he hasn't had to been perfect, but I think that he's been looking really solid throughout. You know, last night he had to play a lot of shorthanded hockey, and I thought he looked really good there for the Canadians. And he was kind of the favorite to be the number one guy, but Sebastian Kosa started the term, and it's, oh, okay, well, that'd be interesting. But kind of just seeing what Garand's been able to do has been good. And I think Lucas Cormier is really kind of showing that he could be a steady defenseman in the NHL someday too.
I love it. Lots more opportunities for Canada to prove us that they're one of the best teams in this tournament. Looking like, I mean, I'm going to look ahead a little bit. They got quarterfinals Wednesday. Is there someone that really could shake things up, or are we going to see a USA-Canada gold medal?
I really think it will look like that. Sweden, they'll have to kind of potentially worry about them at some point. And Canada definitely outplayed Sweden in the pre-tournament game they play against each other. And Sweden's kind of struggled to score. Their top goal scorer, I believe, is a defenseman. So I think it kind of depends on how they kind of find their groove. They've got the best goaltender in the tournament in Jesper Wallstad. But I really would be hard to go against Canada and USA at this point.
We're talking to Stephen Ellis from the Hockey News, who's at the World Juniors in Edmonton. So enough Canada talk. We don't want to pump their tires too much. We got Matthew Nice, big Leafs prospect, of course, significant intrigue here in Toronto. How would you assess just what he's done so far at this tournament? I know I saw last night he had double nose plugs because he had a nosebleed, and he's knocking off helmets. Like, he looks like a rugged player. But what have you kind of assessed in terms of what he's brought so far?
Well, I didn't realize that his kind of his family, it's all from Slovakia, so he speaks a lot of Slovakian, which is kind of cool. But he's been one of the hardest working players on the Leafs. It's been someone where I'm not sure I was the highest on him. I wasn't sure kind of what his full potential would be, but right now he's looking really good. You got to see him at the development camp, and he took some good steps there. And I think the way he's kind of just attacking the plays have been really fun. He's got a lot of energy. He's been one of the team's better playmakers. He's always doing something around the net. So I'd say he's been a huge contributor for this American team that where when you look at them, it's kind of not one star player. It's just a lot of good depth. And I think that's kind of why the Americans have been so hard to play against when they got four lines that are working so well. But Nyes has been a huge part of that.
I know a lot of Leaf fans were not disappointed, but hopeful that he would have decided to not go back to college this year. But we had him on the show last week, and he sounded like a really mature decision. He wants to spend more time developing. He wants to work on, you know, some leadership and, you know, also be a kid. What do you think he should focus on developing this year in his potentially last year of college?
I would like him to just kind of maybe work a bit more on his shot release and kind of be able to take it a bit more. You know, he's a good playmaker. He sets up guys, but there are times where I think I'd like to see him shoot a bit more. And we know he can score. He's got that ability. It's just, I feel like maybe he could almost he could have added probably another 5 or 6, 7, 8 goals this year. So, and that's at the NCAA level, that's pretty good step. But obviously he had such a good season this year, and I think that he's going to continue to develop. I would love to see him continue to use his shot a bit more.
Okay, so keeping with Leafs talk here, obviously you've seen some Leafs prospects on the Finnish side, Topi Niemelä, Roni Hirvonen. What has stood out for those guys? And obviously with less spotlight on them in terms of the Canadians playing on Canadian soil, but have you seen anything that you've liked?
Topi Niemelä in particular has been so much fun to watch. I think he's pulled off like 3 or 4 successful spinoramas, and none of them were like actually useful to the play. It's just kind of like, ha, I could do this.
It's cool to look at least.
Yeah, it's great. It shows that he's got a lot of skill, but he was one of the best defensemen in this tournament, in the round robin for sure. And, you know, the Finnish team might not be the most exciting team out there, and that's been kind of one of the critiques about them. And they didn't necessarily play a great game against Canada, but I thought he looked good himself. You know, he's a really tough defenseman to play against. He could shut things down. He could create the offense, play power play, everything. So I really like him. And Roni Hirvonen seems like he's kind of in on most of Finland's kind of scoring chances at this point. He's kind of got chemistry for a lot of guys, and he's kind of maybe like at the NHL level more of a depth guy, but I think he's a pretty solid depth guy at that because he could play kind of anything the Finnish coaches need him to do.
How close do you think they are to being at an NHL level?
I'd say Hirvonen might be, I don't know, maybe another 2 years away, but Niemelä, man, I think when he's ready, he's ready. This is a guy that just, he's been playing such good hockey for a couple of years where they don't need to rush him. Obviously, the Leafs kind of have a busy blue line, but I'd say when they're ready for him, I think he'll be ready.
That's some nice news for Leafs fans there. I know the Sandin thing is hopefully going to be resolved soon. Not that he's going to slot in down the road here, but it's a good thing to look forward to. Okay, one last one. Latvia making history the other night. Just how cool was it to see that little historical moment? We talked about it on the show yesterday. It was a nice moment.
Absolutely. This is a team where a couple years ago they went out and beat Team Canada at the Men's World Championship, and that was huge on home ice. And then a few weeks later, they lost the goalie that was in it, and Kivalreki. So this is a team that plays with a heavy heart. That player meant a lot to this group. And when they went out there and won, you could see a lot of fans wearing number 80 with his name on the back. So that was cool. And the Latvian fans are awesome. They've traveled here. It's been great. And the post-game press conference afterwards, where they're all hugging each other, talking to the media, was one of the coolest things I've ever seen.
Yeah, I love it. I've had an experience with the Latvian fans myself. I was at that World Championships in Latvia covering it, so I know that they're a rowdy bunch. I'm glad that you got an experience with them in Canada. I'm not surprised that they traveled there. They're pretty fun. So exciting that you got to witness that. Hopefully there's more cool storylines throughout the tournament. Steven, appreciate you joining. Looking forward to seeing what happens the rest of this tournament, and we'll catch up with you down the road.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
That was Steven Ellis from the Hockey News. He's on site at the World Juniors in Edmonton. You can follow him on his Twitter at Steven Ellis, THN, and obviously at thehockeynews.com. He's got lots going on there. It's been pretty exciting to see Team Canada crushing it, whether you are part of the people attending or paying attention or not. They have an off day and then back into the quarterfinals down the road. It's looking like somewhat of a seamless path for them. Don't want to jinx it, but that Canada-USA gold medal showdown seems more likely than not. Looking forward to all that to come. Canada's women's team had some big news yesterday. They announced the 23 players that will be named to the World Championship roster, which is about right around the corner. So they're headed to Denmark, which is actually the first time that the world championships have been in Denmark. They're already headed there today. I was like hoping to get some of them on the show, some of my friends, and they're like, we are literally at the airport. Don't speak to us. So probably won't happen until they're settled or afterwards, but they're headed to Denmark. They got their first game on August 20th against Denmark, and then they're going to play August 23rd against the United States. Those are just pre-tournament games. It's been a little while since they played their last official team games. I'm sure you might remember them winning gold at the Olympics. That was the last time they played together. So pretty exciting for them to be reunited. So the roster, the training camp actually was 142 players invited to Calgary, which is seemingly a lot, but they did a really interesting structure where they included the under 18 team and the under 22 prospects. So a really great experience for the younger girls in the development camp to see what it's like to be at that, you know, senior team level. I was once one of those girls, and it is a really cool experience to be surrounded by like Marie-Philippe Poulin when you're 17 years old and you see the training that goes into it, the mental aspects of preparation. So a really cool experience for them. The team obviously is stacked. they're looking for their third major title in 12 months. They won the world championships and then won the Olympic gold, and they're looking to win another world championship. They got a really good chance. Most of the squad is returned from the Olympics, and usually there isn't a massive quick turnaround from an Olympic to a world championship, but that's just the way that it kind of shook out here with COVID. So it is both a positive and I think a little bit of a stressor. Positive is that this team is basically the same team that won gold just a couple months ago. They have, what I've talked to a lot of these players about, they said the most incredible team dynamic, the most bought in that this team's ever been. They're obviously still in incredibly great shape. They know exactly the systems, the way they need to play to beat the American team, which is probably going to come down to. But on the other side of it, yeah, a little bit of a quick turnaround. Some of the players have actually opted out from joining this time around. Rebecca Johnson, obviously one of the biggest faces in women's hockey for a while, and Melody Daou won't be there. Those were for personal reasons, but Natalie Spooner, obviously we know she's pregnant, so she's not going to be on the team this time around. First time she's going to miss it in quite a few years. And then Claire Thompson, who was a rookie for the Olympic team this winter, set numerous Olympic records in her first year. She has been accepted into medical school, so she's opting out of this tournament this time around. But we're going to see some new faces, Victoria Bach, Kristen O'Neill, and Jesse Eldridge. So they were part of Canada's centralization roster last year. They were cut just before the Olympic Games. So probably the most devastating thing that can happen in sports is to spend 4 years training for this Olympic roster and to be cut basically 1 week before the team flies over. I know these girls well, and it's been a really difficult mental struggle for them, but nonetheless, they made it. They're going to be on this roster this time around. Really excited to see them show up and kind of have a little something to prove. And then Megan Mickelson, she is not quitting. This girl is 37 years old. She's faced a lot of injury issues. She's had children, and she's making her return at this age. She's been battling. You probably saw her in media for the last little while. She was helping cover the Olympics. She was one of those players that got cut right before she made it this time around. So excited to see her return. Also, they announced that the next World Championships will be somewhere in Canada. So Denmark, not a place I'm able to travel to this time around, but really looking forward to seeing Canada back on home ice this time around. Group A is Finland, Japan, Switzerland, and the U.S. Group B is Czechia, Denmark, Germany, Hungary, and Sweden. Canada seems got a really good chance here. Looking forward to that. That's a week or two away. We'll definitely be having more coverage of that, of course. I'm hoping to get some of my friends to join the show when they're not so busy in Denmark, but we'll be bringing you lots of content on that. Jays in action again tonight. There's nothing else to watch, so you are forced to watch the Toronto Blue Jays. 7:07, first pitch, Manoah on the mound, game two of this three-game series with Baltimore. Feels like a must-win. That's it for the A-List Hour. I'll talk to you tomorrow.